Thank you, John and Nancy. Oh, thank you, Mary. Let there be light. Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm going to read verbatim the words that I sometimes just say, and often I leave something out, because even though most of you hear these every single Sunday morning that you're here, they are extremely important and relevant today. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender identification, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or your inabilities. Later I will say that we don't welcome everyone, but we'll get to that. Something to look forward to. If this is one of your first times here, I always encourage you to come to more than one service because our services differ on Sunday mornings. Sometimes I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's minister. Often people from within our congregation do the service, and sometimes people from outside the congregation do it. This morning's offering will be shared with the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, and you can read a little bit about it here in the in your order of service. Holly, would you light the chalice, please? We light this chalice at this time and in this place to rediscover the wondrous gift of free religious community, to renew our faith in the holiness, goodness, and beauty of life, to reaffirm the way of the open mind and full heart, to rekindle the flame of memory and hope, and to reclaim the vision of an earth made fair with all her people one. It's a time in the service when we share our joys and concerns. Going to do something a little different today. We'd like to ask you to address only personal joys and concerns right now. Later in the service, there will be time for you later to express your feelings about what happened this past Tuesday. And I'm going to light a candle right now representing the sorrow, pain, anger, grief, confusion that many of us have been experiencing since the election. Robert Fulghum writes, "All I really need to know about how to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in kindergarten. Wisdom was not at the top of the graduate school mountain, but there in the sand pile at Sunday school. These are the things I learned. Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. Put things back where you found them. Clean up your own mess. Don't take things that aren't yours. Say you're sorry when you hurt somebody. Wash your hands before you eat. Flush. Warm cookies and cold milk are good for you. Live a balanced life. Learn some and think some and draw and paint and sing and dance and play and work every day some. Take a nap every afternoon. When you go out into the world, watch out for traffic, hold hands, and stick together. Wonder. Remember the little seed in the styrofoam cup. The roots go down and the plant goes up, and nobody really knows how or why, but we are all like that. Goldfish and hamsters and white mice and even the little seed in the styrofoam cup. They all die, so do we. And then remember the Dick and Jane books and the first word you learned, the biggest word of all, L-O-O-K, look. Everything you need to know is in there somewhere, the golden rule and love and basic sanitation. ecology and politics and equality and sane living. Take any one of those items and extrapolate it into sophisticated adult terms and apply it to your family life or your work or your government or your world, and it holds true and clear and firm. Think what a better world it would be if we all, the whole world, had cookies and milk about 3 o'clock every afternoon and then lay down on our blankies for a nap. Or if all governments had a basic policy to always put things back where they found them and to clean up their own mess. And it is still true. No matter how old you are, when you go out into the world, it is best to hold hands and stick together. When you go out into the world, it is best to hold hands and stick together. Unitarian Universalist minister Robert Fulghum tells us. But whose hands should we hold? With what people should we stick together? Before Tuesday, November 8th, I would have said that we aspire to hold hands with all people everywhere, and that the goal of humanity is to stick together, period. Here is what Wendell Berry wrote about holding hands. We clasp the hands of those that go before us and the hands of those who come after us, challenging us with a wider, larger vision of what holding hands means. And before November 8th, I would have said that, on balance, this country, this United States of America, despite setbacks and stumbles and starts and stops throughout our history, this country was on track to achieve a kind of inclusiveness that the world has never known. However slowly we were moving towards that inclusiveness, the journey towards peace, justice, and human rights, the dream of bending that arc of the universe towards justice, has taken a major hit. I don't find the story of how Georgie Radburn saved the world through baseball any more audacious or far-fetched than what happened here in the good old U.S. of A. on Tuesday. I grew up in a Republican household in rural Pennsylvania. I grew up with kind and caring and compassionate Republicans and Presbyterians. The first presidential campaign that I have a memory was 1952. I was probably in utero. The 1952 one, Dwight David Eisenhower versus Adlai Stevenson. I remember the I like Ike buttons. I think I may even have one somewhere in a box. But I knew that I did not like Ike, though I don't think that I disliked him. No, at the age of 7, I liked Adlai Stevenson. I think I was being contrary. It has only been within the last few days that I have realized how important it was to me that we talked politics around the dinner table when I was growing up. Well, I didn't do much talking. I wasn't supposed to, but I certainly listened. By the time that I was in my late teens and early 20s, I understood completely that politics is personal, and the personal is political. Something some of you may associate with the feminist movement of the 60s and the 70s. But this is a maxim that has always been true. The political is personal and the personal is political. Politics affects everything that we do. Fast forward to 1972 and George McGovern versus Richard Nixon. By this time, I was a young adult living in another small town in rural Pennsylvania, though not the one I grew up in, but 20 miles from that one. I was a registered Republican. All my friends were Democrats. Some of the people in this small town thought that we were a radical bunch of folks. The editor of the newspaper called the recycling center, which my friends and I started and ran successfully for several years, he called that a communist plot. I am not making this up. I became chair of the Republicans for McGovern Committee. I was the only one on the committee. But I wasn't working full-time then. I went door to door with my then 7-year-old son, who's possibly even farther left than I am today. My Republican ward, that was the ward that I worked, there in that small town in rural northwestern Pennsylvania, went for McGovern. Unfortunately, Nixon trounced McGovern. I remember being sad and a little depressed, but not devastated, not hopeless. But I had learned something important and something that continued to inspire me and energize me over the years as I protested, joined social action movements and organizations, voted. People want information. They want to try to understand what's going on. 1972 may sound like ancient history to some of you. This was the Vietnam era, the rise of another tide of feminism. We were just beginning to learn a little bit about Watergate. This was an era when more people were home during the day. This was a time when a person such as myself, working a ward, would most likely be invited into the home. There wasn't much fear of having a stranger come into your house. Working a ward, going door to door, sitting down with people and talking about the issues, about what is important or not to them, this takes an incredible amount of time. It also gave me a tremendous faith in the American people and great optimism about fulfilling the promise of this unique experiment in democracy that we call the United States. Fast forward again, this time to 1982, a decade later. Ronald Reagan becomes president that year. I was depressed and sad, and I might even have said after that election that I was devastated. But I didn't know the meaning of devastated then. I did not, however, feel hopeless or have a sense that the United States was badly damaged. I and my friends started working towards the next election. We also got involved in various grassroots organizations. Several times I have mentioned the one that I was deeply invested in, and some of you may have worked in this one too, Beyond War. I know, Ken, I think you know about that one. The movement had a modest goal, ending war on the planet. We still haven't quite finished that. But we had two slogans that were you know, on all our literature and that we used in presentations. The first one was, "We are one." This may not sound radical to anybody in this room, but it was radical. It is radical that we are one interconnected people on this planet. And our other slogan was the Einstein quote, "Since the advent of atomic power, everything has changed except our way of thinking." That's not the exact quote, paraphrasing a little. There were a lot of Unitarian Universalists involved in the Beyond War movement. It's difficult to explain the experience of going into people's homes and to various service clubs, such as the Rotary Club, and being on the radio and on television. Yes, we were on television. These were the days of the Capital Times. We had a willing, ready ear in the media then. We're searching for common ground, for something that we could all agree on, no matter what our political party or philosophy, for a base of common agreement from which we could begin a dialogue. And we had our presentation with the BBs. Have you ever been to one of these Beyond War? Yeah, presentations. I was at First Unitarian then. A lot of people were involved there. We took a metal pail, and then we had BBs, and each BB represented X number of nuclear weapons. There were a lot of BBs. And then we would go into homes, or we would go to the service clubs. We would ask people to close their eyes and just listen while we poured the BBs into the metal bucket. It took a very long time. You hear those BBs going into that bucket, and you grasp the enormity of it and the insanity of it, of the fact that just one of those could wipe out great numbers of human beings. Searching for common ground is not new territory, nor is the belief that we have to change our way of thinking. I was somewhat surprised last week when Mike McCabe of the Blue Jean Nation talked about the importance of thinking outside the box and not getting stuck on labels or labeling people if we want to fix our democracy, and he talked about power and money and things that we already know. So I guess I was kind of disappointed in that. And in a few moments, I'll get back to something else that McCabe said that I don't agree with. Fast forward now to the 2016 presidential race and to the failure of this country to stop the momentum of a demagogue. If you need the definition of a demagogue, I'll give it to you in a minute. We failed to take Trump seriously, and look what has happened. We did not think that a bigoted, hateful, misogynist could, well, you fill in the blank, could survive the primary season, could win any primaries, or at least a significant number, could get the nomination of one of the two major political parties in this country, could actually become president of the United States. The last couple of days, I have actually been able to smile grimly at that joke that's going around about, oh, I guess it is true. We tell our kids anybody can become president of the United States. Although it's not really funny. When I was in Springdale, Utah, a couple of weeks ago, Springdale, Utah borders one of the entrances to Zion National Park. I checked in at the motel where I've been staying for several years because I'm friends with the managers and they give me a great deal in the room that I stay in. I've had many conversations over the past 5 years with these managers, some really fascinating theological discussions. They were born and raised Mormon. Well, I made this mistake of saying to Mark, in response to something he had said, please don't tell me that you're voting for Trump. The conversation went downhill from then. Voices were raised, mostly mine. I didn't have a response to my question about the way Trump treats and talks about women. Then, in that same, just a little over two weeks ago, I was climbing up a mountain in Zion National Park, and I was talking to a young French mother, two kids with her, and she said to me, what's going on in this country? And she said, you know, usually we Europeans want to emulate and copy you. Please don't copy us, she said. And when I was in Romania in late July, I had a wonderful conversation in English, thank goodness, with a young Romanian man who said, what are you doing in your country? We are so frightened. I need to be very clear about one thing. I get that we, as a nation, have abandoned too many people in this country. People in Appalachia, coal miners, steel workers in Pennsylvania, auto workers in Youngstown, the rubber industry workers in Akron. I grew up in Northwest rural Pennsylvania. I understand this. I get it. I agree with politicians who also get it. This is not new. The abandonment of workers when technology changes or factories move to other countries or resources run out or any number of reasons, it's not new. My great uncle, think oil. I grew up about 18 miles from the first oil well in the world, commercial oil well. My great uncle was a big deal at Pennzoil. None of that exists anymore. Those big tanks in my own town are sitting there empty. They're not coming back, those jobs. Northwest Pennsylvania has been depressed for at least as long as I've been alive. But the answer to this kind, to any kind of economic distress and despair, these economic problems that bring so much hopelessness to large numbers of people in this country, these problems will not be solved by saying that it's okay for a misogynist bully to become the president of the United States. Misogyny, a hatred of women. And by the way, there's only one definition of misogyny in the dictionary. That's it. So it is that after many years of activism, this election has brought me to despair, to the brink of despondency. I am saddened beyond words. I have been betrayed by this country. The promises of equal opportunity, of a land where anyone, no matter the color of their skin or their gender identification or whether they have disabilities, oh wait, that was the welcome.
Yeah.
Yes, here we are again. Whether or not they have head coverings, scarves, or yarmulkes, That's gone. It is now okay to openly express hatred of others. It is okay to be afraid of anyone who is not white and male. Women are second-class citizens in this country. Fear of women is as deeply ingrained in the soul of this country as is fear of people of color. And we should all be ashamed of that fact. No one can be excused for voting for Trump. No one, for whatever reasons they may have told themselves. On Monday, the day before the election, I stopped at the car shop that maintains my ancient Volvo. And I walked into the small reception area, and there was somebody different behind the reception desk. The person had quit. I asked to speak to so-and-so. Oh, he doesn't work here anymore. He quit too, and I'm like, wait a minute, I was just here 6 weeks ago. What do you mean they're not here? And for a moment, I thought maybe I'd had a small stroke. Where was I? Was I in the right place? How could there be a complete turnover of personnel in just a few weeks? Well, that's how I feel now. Am I in the right place? Am I still in the United States of America? I can't believe some of the comments I'm hearing on BBC News and on PBS News. And these are interviews. The first one was an interview with a young Muslim woman who became an American citizen on Wednesday, the day after the election. And they asked her about Trump's comments about immigrants and everything. And she said, oh, he didn't mean that. And this from the PBS NewsHour. They were interviewing people in Pennsylvania, my home state, remember, who voted for Trump, and they asked a woman, and she said, well, what this country doesn't realize is that everyone here thinks just like Trump. Some of you have sent me helpful, thoughtful material during these last few days, and I greatly appreciate that. Thank you. And one concerns the state legislature in Alaska, which is deliberately, do I have this right, bipartisan now? Okay. Well, you can expand on that.
Just the assembly.
It was also helpful to me to be reminded of the part that economic anxiety, white male backlash, and suspicion of Washington all played in this election. And I agree with those things. These three factors are huge. And we as a society need to pay attention to their importance. However, the fact that underlies and trumps all, I couldn't help it, all of these factors is this. We have legitimized hatred by allowing this bully, this misogynist, by allowing a man who makes fun of the disabled and would require religious tests for entering the country. What happened to separation of church and state? This makes me very nervous, of course, but we have legitimized hate by letting this man become president. What have we done? There was no excuse whatsoever for voting for Donald Trump, and I don't believe that there can be national reconciliation unless and until Mr. Trump recognizes his hate speech for what it is and recants his statements publicly and in front of the whole nation. Will that happen? I doubt it. I don't believe that someone like him is capable of making that great of a change. And while I would love to be proved wrong, I am bracing for at least 4 more years of no reconciliation on the national scene, or maybe at the local level. So I now have my title for these remarks, which I had called Untitled, Legitimizing Hate, A Story of Betrayal. Last Sunday, Mike McCabe said that we have an empathy deficit. No, we don't. We have a calling out deficit. We have the emperor has no clothes deficit. I don't know if that's a reference that younger people in this room get. The emperor has no clothes, okay. If Trump had been called out from the very beginning, this would not have happened. We do not bid you welcome if you are a bigot, a bully, a misogynist, a person of hate, a demagogue. A demagogue is a leader who makes use of popular prejudices and false claims and promises in order to gain power. Many of us, in fact, I'd say at least half of the people in this country have plenty of empathy. We have empathy for the oppressed, for the downtrodden, for those less fortunate than ourselves. But we do not have, nor should we ever have, empathy for those doing the oppressing. All those who have been treated as the other, all those who have been thought of as less than, have waited long enough, too long, to be treated as equals, as legitimate human beings, whatever their status, capabilities, strengths, weaknesses, none of that matters. We are all in this mess together, this mess that we call life. Together we will survive, divided we won't. It's that simple. All we really need to know, we did indeed learn in kindergarten. That's whimsy, I know, Fulgham's stuff, writings are whimsy, but there's often truth in the whimsical. To the words of Unitarian Universalist minister Mark Morrison Reed, the central task of the religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. It is the church that assures us that we are not struggling for justice on our own, but as members of a larger community. The religious community is essential, for alone our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength too limited to do all that must be done. Together, our vision widens and our strength is renewed. May it be so. Go in peace, buy bread, it's comfort food.